Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, the Epistles, and the Book of Revelation, put together for us by Ron Eldred, who has spent a great deal of time and effort to prepare these wonderful programs that we're able to present here at WHOJ. We are thankful for the opportunity to come into your homes and to bring this wonderful account of St. Paul, whom we were left in Ephesus and dealing with some of the major problems that he ran into there. So Ron, maybe you could fill us in just a moment about Ephesus and the silversmiths, which we're beginning on now as we continue our series.
Yes, we've been talking about St. Paul's at least a two-year stay in Ephesus. It's been debated by scholars exactly how long it was, but it was probably between the year 52 and 54 and maybe 55 A.D. And we've already discussed about how he'd spent some time in prison there, the difficulties he had had, keeping in mind that Ephesus was one of the most important cities in the ancient world. It's very famous, a very large city, probably a city of half a million people, which of course would have been a huge city at that time. There would only been probably at least a couple more cities bigger. One would have been Rome, which had a population during the time of Christ of about a million. And Alexandria, Egypt, are probably about a half a million, three quarters of a million, something like that. But we've come to this point where St. Paul had a conflict with the silversmiths there. And this is a well-known story. Most of the Greek and Egyptian gods were worshipped in Ephesus, as well as Artemis. We talked about Artemis, the goddess Artemis, during our last session. So the artisans would have made statuettes of other gods as well as she. She was the patron goddess of the city of Ephesus, the god of the hunt, things of that sort. Paul became embroiled in a dispute with the artisans, whose livelihood depended upon selling the statuettes of Artemis to, and other statues as well, but especially of Artemis, to foreign tourists and pilgrims. We find this story told in Acts 19. Paul's preaching was causing many Greeks to stop buying their statues. So a silversmith, his name was Demetrius, we're told, called together the other craftsmen and began telling them the danger of what Paul was preaching. That since much of their livelihood depended on the selling of idols, the idols of false gods, they were very angered at Paul for hurting their trade and discrediting their goddess, Artemis. They began shouting and threw the whole city into an uproar. When Paul was accused of hurting Artemis and her temple, the mob gathered together in the city's large theater. Paul wanted to go and to speak to them, but the disciples, his disciples, and officials of the province begged him not to go where they were. It'd just be nothing but trouble. So eventually the city clerk was able to quiet them by saying that Paul had not actually attacked Artemis, that he had been neither sacrilegious or blasphemous of their goddess. And after telling the crowd that they were in danger of being charged with rioting for no reason and not to do anything rash, he told them that they could take the matter to the city courts. They were not satisfied. Then he dismissed the assembly. And then you don't really hear too much more, if anything more, about that in the Acts of the Apostles. But that could have been a real problem, because the Romans wouldn't put up, the Romans were in charge there, the Roman army, and they wouldn't have put up with people rioting or, getting out of hand. When they put down these kind of things, they usually put them down with a great deal of violence. It was a warning.
Well, Ron, before we leave Ephesus, as you say, such an important city, you mentioned earlier that Paul performed miracles as a part of his ministry. Can you say something about that before we move on?
Although charisms, that is, gifts, and miracles are important to our faith, for God provides them to attest to the truth that, that whatever people are teaching and this, that, and the other. But they shouldn't be emphasized so much that we lose sight of the faith itself. I've known of people who are on the constant lookout for our Blessed Mother's latest apparition, but don't practice their son's teaching as well as they should. Father Edart, whom we've quoted several times in earlier sessions, he points out that the Acts of the Apostles show that miracles are not the principal cause of evangelization, even if they do sometimes contribute actively towards it. He states that when crowds are converted, this is due primarily not to miracles, but to the word preached. He cautions that some miracles are misunderstood and become a source of confusion instead of engendering belief. For example, he cites the healing of the paralytic at Lystra in Acts 14, when they thought Paul and Barnabas were the gods Zeus and Hermes. To show how superficial faith based solely on miracles alone is, immediately after this episode, Paul was stoned after the crowd had been instigated by a group of Jews from Iconium and Antioch. That story is told in Acts 14. Father Edart cites Acts 16 as another example of people misunderstanding a miracle. When the owner of a slave girl became angry when Paul freed his slave girl from possession by a spirit of divination, because the master had lived off of his slave's gifts. Father refers to one other incident told in Acts 28, where Paul was bitten by a viper. That is a very poisonous snake, but he didn't die, leading those who witnessed the event to conclude that Paul was a god instead of believing his message of the good news. Moreover, Jesus performed numerous miracles, but many didn't believe what he said about his divinity. For example, the scribes and Pharisees acknowledged that he performed miracles. In fact, at times they said, yes, he did, but it wasn't from God, it was from Beelzebub, or, you know, some idol. But the great majority of them refused to believe that he was the Messiah, let alone the Son of God. However, Father Edart cautions us not to undervalue miracles and charisms as non-existent or useless, because the history of the proclamation of the gospel is replete with these gifts of the Holy Spirit, which along ordinary and extraordinary ways have brought many non-believers to the faith. At least it gets people's attention, I guess, to begin with.
Sure.
And he says that we have to acknowledge that miracles, although at times misunderstood by those present, are often the source of conversions, even in St. Paul's experience. And I think that continues right on down to the present day, which is one of the reasons that the church emphasizes the importance of so many miracles, you know, during a canonization or beatification process.
So the church certainly still believes in the possibility that miracles still do happen.
In fact, I was reading the other day, or somebody told me the other day, that they thought that they had another miracle that would attest to John Paul II's sanctity. It had to do with someone who was instantly cured of Parkinson's disease, which is a disease that John Paul himself had.
How about that? Well, hopefully that is true. Well, Ron, Paul returns to Greece. Let's talk about that a little bit after his stay in Ephesus.
He left for Greece via Macedonia, which was north, the northern north of Greece, instructing and encouraging the churches along the way. And after a 3-month stay in Greece, he planned to go to ship by ship to Syria. But when a plot by Jews against him was uncovered, he and some companions went by land through Macedonia. From there, they sailed from Philippi, or I've heard it pronounced Philippi, to Troas, which was a port on the Aegean Sea. Paul spent a week there. This story is told in Acts 20. As he addressed the people on this occasion, a young man listening to him fell asleep and fell from a three-story building in which the meeting was held, and he was killed by the fall. And Paul revived him. This story is again told further down in Acts 20. Later, some of his companions took him aboard a ship at Assos, which was the city of Mysia in the Roman province of Asia, which would be Asia Minor, or what is Turkey today. And they sailed for Mytilene, a city on the island of Lesbos in the Aegean Sea, just south of Troas, then embarking the following day for Chios, a large island situated in the Aegean Sea and only 5 miles off the coast of the Asia Minor coast. The next day they touched at Samos, or Samos. I had a class in ancient history many years ago. The professor, when we get into the Greek, he would always pronounce the O in Greek words as ah, or os, rather than os, like you say in Latin. So I'm not an expert on either one of the languages, but I have a tendency to pronounce Greek names with the os.
Following his good example.
Following his good example. But it's an island in the Aegean Sea about 20 miles southwest of Ephesus. And the day following, they sailed to Miletus, where Paul met with the elders of the church of Ephesus, then bid them farewell on a nearby beach. That's a very famous story. All of this happened in 57 AD, probably. Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus, not to go into the city, so that he might not have to spend time in Asia, any more time in Asia, because he wanted to get to Jerusalem in a hurry. He wanted to get there by Pentecost, apparently.
Okay, why was Paul in such a hurry to get back to Jerusalem?
Well, Paul tells us in the Acts that he was going to Jerusalem, bound in the Spirit, is how he puts it, not knowing what was going to happen to him there, except that the Holy Spirit had informed him in every city that imprisonment and afflictions awaited him there. He spent the next night in Miletus encouraging the Ephesian leaders who he had met with and admonishing them to be careful of enemies from within and from without their local church. Keeping in mind now, they probably walked or rode horses or something about 20 miles to come to the beach there to meet with him rather than him going to Ephesus. After having spoken to them, he knelt down and prayed with them all. They all wept and embraced Paul and kissed him and were sorrowful, most of all, because he had told them that he would never see them, or they would never see him again. Then they took him to the ship to set sail for Caesarea Maritima, then on to Jerusalem. And again, that story continues in Acts 20, and the year was probably 58 A.D.
Okay, it's interesting, Ron, that during this trip, Luke often refers to Paul and his companions as we, instead of just as Paul himself. Is there any significance to that at all?
Yeah, those have been considered the so-called we part of the Acts of the Apostles. Some scholars, among them Luke Timothy Johnson, a Catholic biblical scholar that we've quoted quite a few times in our series, he believes that Luke might be speaking of himself in the so-called we passages found in the Acts. Remember, he wrote the Acts, of course. Other scholars have debated whether Luke might not have used the first person plural simply as a literary device to lend color to the narrative. However, Catholic Answers, on their internet site, states that it is more probable that the we refers to Luke, or another companion of Paul, whose data Luke used as a source in his when he put together his gospel.
Okay, now Paul is returning to Jerusalem and is imprisoned at Caesarea. We had left Paul sailing for Miletus on his way back to Jerusalem, ending his third missionary journey. So, apparently, did he make it?
Well, essentially, the third journey is ended by this time. As I said, he's on his way back to Jerusalem. The ship first sailed to Kos, which is an island in the Aegean Sea, south of Miletus. And the next day, on the island of Rhodes, which is a very large island, which is off the southwest coast of Asia Minor, that is what would be Turkey today. And from there to Patara, which was a flourishing maritime and commercial city on the southwest coast of Lycia, on the Mediterranean coast of Asia Minor. A couple centuries later, it was the birthplace of St. Nicholas, better known as Santa Claus. He was the bishop of that place. After finding a ship going to Phoenicia, he had to get another ship on another ship, transfer ships. From Patara, they sailed within sight of Cyprus. This is another very large island on their way to Tyre, Phoenicia, which, of course, is on the Mediterranean coast, getting closer and closer, of course, to Palestine, which was a little south of there. Paul and his companions stayed in Tyre for a week while the ship's cargo was unloaded. They sought the Christians in the city, they looked them up, and who warned Paul not to go to Jerusalem. But he and his companions departed anyway when the ship was ready to set sail. They stopped off at Ptolemais, which was a Palestinian harbor on the Mediterranean north of Carmel. Carmel is a small mountain that comes right down to the sea, I understand. There, of course, it's a very, very famous place where Elijah, of course, as we discussed in our series on the Old Testament, defeated the 450 Baal priest. And also, if I recall right, it's where St. Simon Stock was, I think it was the Blessed Mother appeared to him there. And this, gave rise to the brown scapular.
And, of course, to our Carmelites who are connected
right.
South of Terre Haute at the entrance of Allendale. There
right.
They go back to Carmel, Mount Carmel.
Well, there at Carmel, or Carmel as they pronounce it, at least in California, they met with the local Christians for a day, and then they went on to Caesarea Maritima. That simply Maritima means the city of Caesarea by the sea. Maritima being a word meaning the sea. When they arrived at Caesarea, and you'll hear that pronounced, I think, more correctly in Latin, Caesarea, or Caesarea. I've heard it spelled, pronounced a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. They went to the house of Philip, the evangelist, who was one of the seven original deacons, remember, along with St. Stephen. And he stayed with him, and he had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. Also a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea who foretold that the Holy Spirit had told him that the Jews at Jerusalem would bind and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. Of course, the Christians there begged Paul not to go to Jerusalem. But in spite of their weeping, their entreaties for him not to go, he was ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. We find this story in Acts 21.
Okay, so Paul's heading into major trouble. He arrives in Jerusalem, visits the temple, a riot starts, is arrested. Can you say something about that, how he got into trouble with the local Jews?
Well, when he and his companions got to Jerusalem, they were welcomed by some of the local Christians who took him to see James the Less. James the Less, of course, as we found out in some of our earlier sessions, was the bishop there. He was a cousin of Jesus from Nazareth. Paul told him and the other elders the wonderful things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And they glorified God when they heard this. They responded that there were many Jews who had converted to Christianity. but continued to follow the law of Moses. However, they said that the Jewish converts in Jerusalem had heard that Paul had taught the Jews living among the Gentiles along the way of his journeys that they didn't have to be circumcised or observe the Jewish customs anymore if they converted. Well, supposedly that was supposed to have been decided, you know, at the Council of Jerusalem back in 49 and 50. But still, there are Jews in around Jerusalem who had become Christians who didn't like that and didn't really go along with that. Sometimes they were called the Judaizers. The James and the others, the leaders in Jerusalem, felt like this would surely confuse the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. So to head off any trouble, they told Paul that he should take four Jewish catechumens to have them purified along with himself and to have their heads shaven to prove to the local Jewish Christians that he observed the law of Moses, which, of course, although he was now a practicing Catholic, a Christian, Paul, he still observed very closely the law of Moses, the dietary laws, the purification laws, and those kind of things. In fact, he even had Timothy, who he was later to make a bishop, he even had him circumcised.
And of course, it was to keep good relations with the Jewish people that he was traveling among.
That's right, or back in Jerusalem now. Of course, they were referring to the observances of the law dealing with ritual purity, sabbatical observances, a diet, and other matters. The next day, he fulfilled their instructions as he was told to do.
Okay, nonetheless, Paul was about to get into trouble with the local non-Christian Jews anyway.
That's true, as all too frequently happened when Paul worked among the Gentiles. The Jews turned against him. When Asiatic Jews who were visiting Jerusalem saw Paul, some of them had heard of him or had actually perhaps even seen him or heard him preach and teach in different places. When they saw Paul and his four catechumens in the temple, they stirred up trouble among the crowd. They charged that he had been teaching men everywhere against the people, the law, and the temple. They also charged him with bringing pagans into the temple, defiling the holy place. You remember, that was really against the law. In fact, it was so important to the Jews that even the Romans would enforce it. In fact, the Roman soldier couldn't even go into the temple precincts. The truth of the matter is that they had earlier seen Paul with Trophimus, the Ephesian in the city, and assumed that he had brought him into the temple. The Jews were so aroused by this that they seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple and tried to kill him. Word reached the tribune, who was the top military official in Jerusalem at the time, of a cohort, that all Jerusalem was in a commotion. So immediately he rushed soldiers to the scene. This is one thing the Romans always did. Anytime there's anything that seemed like it was going to get out of hand, a riot or anything like that, the Romans were very quick to come down on it and sometimes very brutally. When the Jews saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. And so the tribune arrested Paul, ordered him bound with chains, and proceeded to question him as to what he had done to arouse the crowd. The Jews were making so much noise that the tribune had to take Paul into the barracks to hear what he was saying.
I believe, Ron, that the tribune had confused Paul with another rabble-rouser?
Yes, he had. He mistakenly thought Paul was an Egyptian who had recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness. But as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he asked the tribune if he could speak to him privately. Paul told him that he was a Jewish citizen from Tarsus in Cilicia and asked him if he could say something to the crowd. The tribune consented, so Paul addressed them from the steps of the barracks.
What was St. Paul's defense before the crowd?
He proceeded to tell them that he was a Jew born in Tarsus in Cilicia, but came to Jerusalem to study under the very famous Rabbi Gamaliel and was educated according to the law of Moses. He goes on to tell them that he was so zealous for the law that he persecuted Christians to the death, and by binding and delivering both men and women to prison, and that the high priest and the whole council of elders could bear witness to this. Then he goes on to describe how he journeyed to Damascus to arrest and bring any Christians back to Jerusalem in bonds to be punished. Next he told the crowd how Jesus appeared and spoke to him, how he was blinded, and how this brought about his conversion in an instant. Then he relates how he received his sight again from a devout Jewish Christian named Ananias, was told that he was to be a witness for Christ, and was baptized. After this, he told the crowd how he returned to Jerusalem, where they were praying in the temple. And the Lord told him to get out of Jerusalem quickly because the Jews wouldn't listen to his testimony. Jesus told him to leave at once, for he was going to send him far away to the Gentiles. This story is told in Acts 22.
And of course, this was the point in Paul's speech that the crowd really turned ugly.
That's right. Up to this point, they were intently listening to him. But at the mention of the Gentiles, they shouted, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he ought to not to live." In other words, any mention of Gentiles to Jews by Paul during his three missionary journeys invariably aroused their emotions to a fever pitch. The crowd became so unruly that the tribune had him taken into the barracks and ordered that he be whipped to find out why they shouted so vehemently against him. However, as the soldiers were preparing to whip him, he told the centurion in charge that he was a Roman citizen by birth, who in turn went to the tribune to inform him of this, for it was illegal for a man who was an uncondemned Roman citizen to be bound and whipped to exact information from him. And in other words, Roman citizens could be whipped, but they either already had to be convicted of a crime. It wasn't okay. Something they could whip them and try to get the information out of them, like they could, of course, non-Romans. But of course, Paul, having been born and raised in Tarsus, he was a Roman citizen.
And that often saved him in some pretty difficult circumstances.
Well, it saved him from being crucified.
Yeah.
He had his head cut off instead. At least that was quick.
Yeah.
Well, the next day, the tribune sent Paul before the chief priest and Sanhedrin to be questioned.
Okay, well, I think we're running out of time. So to our listening audience, we say, may God bless you all, always and in all ways.